This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for coming. I'm just going to make a few prefatory remarks before the evening's events get underway. Bear with me, please. Hi, I'm Michael, and I work at Zone Books. On behalf of Zone, we would like to welcome you all here tonight for an evening of, about, and through The Voice. We'll be hearing from Shane Butler, the author of the recent Zone title, The Ancient Phonograph, which is an excellent book. Shane's going to give a short talk inspired by the book, and then there's going to be a short back and forth about two of the source texts from the book, and then Joseph Koechler will interpret those texts and follow that up with a performance of his own. Just a couple housekeeping-style things before we get started. We would really like to thank Sina and Will and everyone from Cabinet for helping us and hosting this event. We really love the space, very happy to be here. We do have copies of Shane's book for sale. You can find them at the back table. Megan is back there. We do take cards, although very awkwardly, but we're getting better. There's going to be no Q&A after the performance. There will be a sort of general milling about period during which casual conversation may occur. If you have any questions about the material and you want to talk to Shane and Joseph about their work, don't be shy about approaching them. They're very nice. Okay, so about The Ancient Phonograph. In The Ancient Phonograph, Shane Butler takes us back to an age long before Edison when writing itself was still relatively new. He meticulously reconstructs a series of Greek and Roman soundscapes ranging from Aristotle to Augustine. The resonant world we encounter there is at first unfamiliar, populated by texts that speak and sing, often with no clear difference between the two. But Butler discovers a commonality that invites a deeper understanding of why voices mattered then and why they have mattered since. The book has been called a brilliant tour de force, defamiliarizing our contemporary assumptions, not just about the voice, but about the very mainsprings of meaning. Joanna Drucker has called the book that rare academic work that is delightful to read, which is true. A short note about the participants. Shane Butler is professor of classics at Johns Hopkins University. He's the author of The Hand of Cicero and The Matter of the Page, Essays in Search of the Ancient and Medieval Authors, and is a co-editor of Synesthesia in the Ancient Senses. Joseph Koechler is a singer, writer, and interdisciplinary artist who often transforms his experiences and observations into stories, videos, and arias. He is currently artist-in-resident at the University of Michigan, where he's working on Let Me Die, a durational performance that combines many operatic death scenes. Without further ado, I give you Shane Butler.
Thank you, Michael. 3,000 years ago, perhaps on a Thursday, though they would not have called it the day of Thor, but the day of Zeus, a group of people not much larger or smaller than this one, while the winter wind raged outside, not as cold, but cold enough, turned its ears toward a single person who stood among them and sang of a war that even for them already belonged to an impossibly distant past, and of the wrath of its melancholic hero, Achilles. Fast forward, and here we are again. Again, you ask? So much has changed. And yet we have something in common with that other audience. For them, writing was a technology that still lay a century or two in the future. We, by contrast, live a century and a half beyond another great invention, that of the phonograph. What we share with our pre-literate Greek counterparts, therefore, is the fact that we both stand 100 years or so outside that long stretch of Western history in which writing was both available and unrivaled as a record of speech and song, more lasting than that of human memory. If someone were to ask us, Who invented the first technology to record the human voice? Most of us would answer Thomas Edison, unless you're French, in which case you might answer with the name of a mostly forgotten poet and inventor who dreamed up but did not build something similar a year or so before. But a moment's reflection reveals that both answers are wrong. The credit surely belongs instead to the unnamed inventors of writing, especially of syllabic and alphabetic writing. If our modern instinct is to think of the voice as instead something that you cannot write down, then that is in part because Edison's phonograph and its successors have trained us to think that way. But Edison himself called his invention a talking machine. And if its trademarked name, the phonograph, is a new word made from Greek roots that mean to write, graphein, the voice, phoné, it's important to note that phoné is also the ordinary word in ancient Greek for speech. In a literal etymological sense, all alphabetic writing is phonographic. But be careful. That's not only because writing records language. From antiquity through to the age when Edison's invention began to change everything, literary writing was full of sound that cannot be reduced to any clear linguistic function. It was only after Edison that poets began to abandon, rapidly if not ever entirely, things like meter and rhyme and a range of sound effects whose technical names fill dictionaries that almost no one reads anymore. And that is why, until Edison, readers regularly described reading literature as an act not so much of interpreting as one of listening. My book, The Ancient Phonograph, looks and listens back to this once upon a time, especially to its early chapters. But it also looks forward to ways that we might listen better to opera, or to Billie Holiday, or to Jimi Hendrix, or to Joseph Koeckler. What we learned about the voice during the long age of writing supremacy is still with us, and that may not be such a bad thing. For though it may seem paradoxical, a relatively limited phonographic technology like writing may actually teach us more about how and why voices matter than do newer, better ones that distract us with their stronger, though still problematic, claims of fidelity. So before I bring tonight's rhapsode on stage, to use for him that ancient word for Homeric vocalists that means stitcher of songs, let me say a word or two about what the literature of classical antiquity might help us to listen for again. Let's think of tragedy. Let's think, indeed, of Oedipus. Many people who have never read Sophocles' most famous play nevertheless know that its title character unwittingly kills his father and marries his mother. It's a timeless tale, Dr. Freud assured us a century ago. But to suppose that this is the only reason Athenians went to see the play is a bit like assuming that the opera fan goes to see Madame Butterfly in order to learn about the perils of having sex with an American sailor, or to La Traviata or La Bohème in order to ponder the devastating effects of tuberculosis. Though we often forget it, Greek tragedies were operas or musicals or something like that. For they were masked and costumed and sung and danced and rhythmically recited and accompanied by musical instruments and the occasional special effect. And from a performative point of view, there's a very good reason that tragedies are, well, tragic. You put a talented vocal performer on the stage, make him speak and sing, and you slowly press a fist into his stomach, a fist that is the incremental realization that he has killed his own father and married his own mother. Whatever else tragedy is or does, it gives us characters who struggle to express themselves while being pressed upon by extraordinary circumstances, by pain either physical, emotional, or both. This is what ancient audiences were thrilled by in the theater of Dionysus, but it is also what ancient readers knew to read for. Antiquity's second vocal lesson is a related one. When language breaks down, it may actually be easier to hear why voices move us. This can happen, for example, in the tragic theme of the unspeakable. As a character tries to say what cannot be said, I've committed parricide and incest, for example, we listen for its expression in non-linguistic sound. The texts of Greek tragedy, in fact, often give us long strings of nonsense syllables meant to scripts for screams and shouts and moans and sighs. But the voice also takes center stage in more ordinary instances of repetition and refrain. We often say that we repeat things for emphasis, and sometimes that's true. But in poetry and song, repetition can also be an invitation to stop listening to what's being said. The message, after all, has already been delivered, and to start listening to the body that is saying it. The third lesson is a bit of a shocking one. Vocal art isn't as much about live voices as we think. Let me borrow a comparandum from opera again. Someone may tell us that they're going to the Met to see a live performance of Tosca. But the truth is that Tosca has already leapt to her death the week before, and she'll do so again the week after. Likewise, it's not just that a lot of people die in Greek tragedy. As famous characters from myth, they're all already long dead before the chorus ever takes the stage. The Homeric rhapsode also sings of death on the Trojan plain, but so too when he begins his song are even the survivors of that most famous of conflicts, long since dead and buried. Such singing is about the reanimation of voices, not so much a living voice as a perpetually undead one. Lesson 4. You can record voices, but so too can voices themselves record. Think of Billie Holiday. To listen to her late recordings is to hear a voice deeply scored by drugs, drink, racism, and sorrow. Or a different example. The Roman Emperor Nero was a famous singer of tragic repertoire, and imperial critics mocked him for his vox fusca, his dark or husky voice. But it's easy to imagine how a seemingly damaged voice could have worked for such music, not just a voice that feels, but a voice that has felt. This is the voice of experience, to borrow a key word from Jimi Hendrix, who expressed his experience not so much with his own voice as in the prosthetic voice of his guitar, an instrument he used like the ancient reed pipe called an aulos, regularly used to accompany tragic performances. Legend held that the aulos was invented by the goddess Athena to imitate the wailing sounds of the sisters of Medusa after she was slain by Perseus. The fifth and final lesson embraces the other four. The voice is a medium, and sometimes the medium is the message. To use a voice, especially as an artist, is to make something out of the complex, fleshy matter of the voice. And this, I believe, is a key reason why ancient poets so often describe other kinds of making in their poems. The audience I asked you to imagine a while ago would have listened for about as long as I have been speaking to the Iliad's lavish description of the manufacture of the shield of Achilles by Hephaestus, god of fire. But all the while, the rhapsode would have been sculpting something equally dazzling out of his voice. That, after all, is what you were there to hear. So too are you here now for the sake of voices, not my voice, but the one to follow, or rather, the ones to follow. Ancient poets would pray to the muses for 100 voices with which to sing. But if ever there was a single man with 100 voices inside him, voices that are simultaneously one voice, and even the voice itself, it's tonight's artist. I'm going to briefly introduce some of what Joseph is going to perform now so as not to interrupt him later. The first two pieces are ancient, one Greek, one Latin, and for both of them I'll be staying up here to read an English translation before Joseph gives us his free but informed interpretation of the original. The first piece will be a lyric poem by an anonymous poet of uncertain date, writing in the style and voice of the once famous poet named Anacreon. It's a love poem, but it tells of the making of a silver wine cup. It would have been sung, and its melody is lost, but both the language and the verse form include far more musical information than would have been the case, than would be the case with English lyrics. And Joseph is going to be working with those surviving values, though he's also going to be taking some creative license. The second piece is instead part of a monologue from the Latin tragedy Hercules by Seneca. In it, the title hero has just awakened from a fit of divinely inspired madness in which he has slaughtered his wife and children. The truth of what has happened is slowly being revealed to him. Listen in the Latin for the repeated nescio quid, I know not what, functioning in Latin as a kind of pronoun for the thing you know is there but cannot yet make out. After that, Joseph will be performing some pieces from his own repertoire, some of which you may have heard before, though I hope we'll hear them tonight with differently primed ears, and that they will in turn shape how we listen to the ancient texts on offer. I'll let him introduce those other pieces himself, but let me offer two more quick notes on their themes. One piece describes a series of hallucinogenic trips. Before you think this is a leap to the super contemporary, I should point out that Odysseus's men drugged themselves in the blissful land of the lotus eaters, refusing to leave. Their enraged captain demanded they continue their journey home to Greece, but they answered, more or less, let's get lost, if I can borrow a lyric from a great musician and drug user, Chet Baker. Far from derailing the plot, the lotus eaters are truest to it, for it is, if Odysseus didn't keep getting lost, there would be no Odyssey, no poem at all. The young Tennyson reprised the scene in an 1832 poem. Here are a few lines of it. Note their sound and the repetition. To hear the dewy echoes calling from cave to cave through the thick twined vine, to watch the emerald colored water falling through many a woven acanthus wreath divine, only to hear and see the far off sparkling brine, only to hear were sweet, stretched out beneath the pine. And by the way, one of Edison's first phonographs was shipped to Britain in order to record the then aged Tennyson reciting his own poetry before he died. Another piece Joseph will perform invokes the sirens, antiquity's most famous singers, luring countless sailors to certain death against the rocks around their island. Only Odysseus was said to have heard them and lived to tell the tale, after having himself tied to his ship's mast and ordering his sailors to plug their own ears with wax. Listen as Joseph sings for the refrain of Here I Am. As I wrote my own book, the ancient voices I struggled to listen to often seemed to be saying no more than this, I'm here. At first I was disappointed, and then it began to sink in that maybe there is nothing more important to hear than this. My book ends on that note, and so too shall I end here now. I just want to add a note of thanks to Joseph for the incredible thrill and honor of collaborating with him. And I'd also like to thank Michael Newton, Megan Gale, and Ramona Nadaf at Zone for making this all happen, as well as the folks at Cabinet for hosting us. So please, a round of applause for all concerned, especially Joseph, as I asked him to join me up here to begin.
A round of applause for Shane Butler, I think, who is really the man of the hour.
So, Pseudo-Anacreon, uncertain date, but before the 2nd century AD, untitled poem, aka the wine cup song. Shape now your silver, Hephaestus, and make me, not armor, with battles, what have I to do? But hollow a wine cup as deep as you're able, on which please do not make the stars or Big Bear. What have I to do with Pleiads or plowmen, but make me some grapevines with bunches of fruit, then add some who trample the grapes with fair Bacchus, and let them be gilded, Bathyllus and love.
I think somebody might be trying to get in that door. Visitor.
It's an acronym.
Ton argyron toreusas hephaistemoi poeson panoplias menuchi tigar machai sikamoi poterion de koilon hoson dune batulnon kai me poie katauto metastra meta maxas ti plei adon melemoi ti dasteros boteo poie sonam pelus moi kai botru as katauton kai chruseus patuntas homu kalolu aio erota kai bathulon.
That's the song. I thought maybe there should be some sort of soundscape or drone going on, and this radiator has come on to fulfill my desire.
Right, so second, the younger Seneca, first century AD, a bit of a monologue from his tragedy, Hercules. What place is this? What land? What worldly spot? Where am I? Where sun first greets the earth? Or north beneath the frigid star, or there beyond the western sea where land gives way to ocean deep. I breathe what air, what ground sustains my tired feet. I must be home. And yet what makes me see upon my porch dead bodies black with gore? Perhaps my mind has not yet shaken off the ghostly sights of hell, but must that demon horde my eyes distract beyond the dark? I dare not say. I dread. I know not what my mind foretells. I know not what, but large it looms and foul.
Qui sic locus, quae regio, quae mundi plaga, ubi sum. Sub ortus solis, an sub cardine glacialis ursae? Num quid esperi I maris extrema telus hunc dat oceano modum? Quas traiumus auras, quod solum feso subest, certe redimus, unde prostata domo video cruenta corpora, annondum exuit simulacra mens inferna, post reditus quoque oberat oculus turba ferialis meis? Pudet fateri, paueo nescio quid mihi, nescio quid animus grande praesagit malum.
So that was, so now moving from Seneca as an author to the life of Seneca.
Seneca and Seneca as also a subject in the Monteverdi opera, The Coronation of Poppea. Two people we've already invoked, Nero and Seneca. This is the scenario. And in Monteverdi's rendering, there's a kind of absurd chorus of Seneca's friends who plead with him or are imploring in this in a certain way, and as a sort of silly chorus, and say, "No, Seneca, life is too pleasant. The air is too clear. You mustn't die." And he says, "I don't want to die." "You mustn't die. I don't want to die." And there's this really kind of long exchange between the two parties. And eventually, Seneca addresses them and says this. So now I'm going to keep us somehow in the realm of Italian opera and also somehow not. This is a kind of a story about my own voice, and every time I'm having a bad day, I compare it to another bad day. I check myself. I think, well, this is a bad day. And every day is, let's face it. But have I had any day that was worse? And then I examine my thoughts and my history, and I always come forth with the following answer.
Thank you. pastilla di mente e cioccolato. So
Remaining also in the realm of Italian opera for just one more moment more. I don't usually do this piece, but I thought it had certain connections to Shane's book and arguments and themes. It's another one of my experiences, and a lot of the work that I've done has come from jobs that I had. In the past, I've had, before I was a full-time artiste, I had many jobs in the New York art world, many low-level jobs. And many of these jobs seemed to concern the voice in some way. My first job, I was working at the Guggenheim hawking audio guides for $8 an hour. And so I was selling, you know, private tours, private narratives. And so I made a kind of audio guide piece about that. And then I worked for a blind gallerist. You might think there are many, but there is, I assure you, at least one. And a lot of what my job involved was reading things to him, the New York Times, etc., and answering the phone for him. I would answer the phone. So, so-and-so is on the phone and say, I can't talk to him, I'm blind. he knows I'm blind. He'll understand. And I also worked at a music publishing company, and my boss there was a kind of a failed opera singer, and she had birds that she would bring in. There was one bird that sang Queen of the Night and made barnyard animal sounds. And very frequently went, and then my boss acquired another bird from an elderly woman on the Upper East Side who had passed away, and then eventually this bird started speaking. It started going,
who's a dirty poop?
Spoke in a kind of New York accent with a smoker's voice. And at some point it dawned on me that this was the revenant voice of the bird's deceased owner. He said,
who's mommy's little pooper?
As a dropping hit the floor of the cage. So that was another job at the music publishing company. And finally, the one that most explicitly involved the voice was my job working for the opera pirate. At one point, I thought my ship had come in, but no, I was on another ship. I was on the ship of the opera pirate. Hit it.
Il pirata è opera, è un tipo che vende copie d'opere. Mi dite l'oro, copiamo i CD, copiamo tutto il giorno, suoni rubati, ma
Preparla col gatto, controlla la sua truppa. Li copiavo più non possa.
At some point in Shane's book, he invokes the River Styx, and this song that I wrote kind of concerns Charon, but more in the popular imagination of today, where the ferryman is sometimes thought of not as a ferryman, but as the driver of a car service, taking you to the underworld. So I like to think of this person coming to my house and, or coming to yours, maybe, preferably, and, you know, calling you and saying, oh, I'm here, and you think, what? And then you wander out, you know, with some caution, and he then beckons you, and you have reservations about getting into the car with him, but you do, and then he takes you to Yonkers, and to, you know, Nyack, and to parallel dimensions, the past, the future, and so on. Perhaps underwater, then back up. And you will just be left to gaze longingly out the window as he says this. So this is kind of a death aria. It's a song about departure, and it's also a vocal departure where I depart from one voice and find another.
Long nights bring me down. Do you agree? Okay, drive me around town. Tonight, hunger fills my cheeks. Why can't we stop somewhere? Why won't you speak to me? I don't understand myself. Why did I hide away? I was a drunk child today. Now we ride away tonight.
Jersey City. Montauk.
And I wonder when we're under, are we ever far? And I wonder when we're under here, are we ever far? Strange language coming in. I'd say roll up the windows if I didn't like the wind. Ooh, but I do. And I wonder when we're under, are we ever far? And I wonder when we're under here, are we ever far from where we start?
And now I'm going to sing one more song that that Shane also mentioned. And as a preface, I will just say that Shane is only the most recent of many great minds to discuss the siren. Goethe reminded us of the dangers of the song of the siren. And Kafka then created a kind of reversal by saying that the real danger of the siren was in their silence. And this song by Tim Buckley is a different kind of reversal, because it's not the song of a siren, it's a song directed to the siren.
Long afloat on shipless oceans, I did all my best to smile, till your singing eyes and fingers drew me loving to your oil. For you sang, sail to me, sail to me, let me enfold you. Well, here I am, waiting to hold you. Did I dream you dreamed about me. Were you here when I was fox? Now my foolish boat is leaning, broken love alone on your rocks. For you sing, touch me not, touch me not, come back tomorrow. I'm as puzzled as the oyster. I'm as troubled as the tide. Should I stand amidst the breakers? Should I lie with death my bride? And you sing, swim to me. Swim to me, let me enfold you. Here I am, here I am, waiting to hold you.
Thank you so much.
And that is the end of the, you know, it's not the end of the evening, but it's the end of things occurring here. So get Shane's book because it's rich and excellent and fantastic, as you may already know or will soon come to learn. Let's give another hand to Shane. Yeah.